Beginning with Luke chapter 14, verses 25 through 30, and then Matthew 16, verses 24 through 26. Now great crowds accompanied him. That would be Jesus. Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?" Thus far, the reading of God's Word. When I was 18 years old, I was a late bloomer. And so I was convinced at the age of 18 that I had bloomed. And I hadn't. We know that now. I was still about 110 pounds. But in my mind, I had bloomed. I had a nice little peach fuzz mustache going there. I had my feathered hair parted down the middle. I knew how to look good. And one time I was out on a date, and the girl I was with had her little side ponytail popping out there, as she did in the 80s. And I was self-confident. I had an unhealthy amount of self-confidence, actually. But on this particular night, it was clear that I was looking good. And the reason why it was clear that I was looking good was because wherever we went, people turned to look at me. When I went into the movie theater, people were looking at me. When we drove down the strip as we cruised, people were looking at me. As I walked into McDonald's to get our after-movie ice cream, people were looking at me. And I was feeling very, very good until I walked up to get our ice cream, and the columns there in that McDonald's had mirrors on them. And I caught myself in the mirror, and I was able to see why everybody was turning to look at me. Right here, I still remember it very well, I had a big bloody tissue from where I had cut myself shaving that day, and had put the tissue on it to stop the bleeding and never removed it. And so that's what everybody was looking at. It would have been nice to have known that. I broke up with that girl because she didn't tell me. You don't, obviously don't care about me if you can't tell me I have a bloody tissue stuck to my face. So, anyway, my point is this. Mirrors are your friends. Even when a mirror reveals something to you that is ugly, that is embarrassing, it's your friend. You need to know. And when we think about work, as we think about work, as we see kind of how we view work and the decisions that we have made and what we have based these enormous decisions upon, work can become a mirror for us. And as we look at those decisions, we can kind of see ourselves more clearly and understand something about ourselves that we might just miss. The problem is, what is overwhelmingly obvious to God and to other cultures is completely missed by us. We can't see ourselves objectively. It's impossible by the definition of the word. And so what we have to do is we have to take glimpses. How do we view work? We know how we view work. Well, how would Jesus criticize that? What's right about that and what's wrong about that? And that's what we're going to do today. And I think what we're going to see, what I hope that we will see as we use work as a mirror and to view ourselves, what we're going to see is that Jesus calls us to love him more than anything in our life, to make him our most precious treasure. And he tells us that he knows that that's a scary thing. He knows it's frightening for us to leave everything behind and follow after him. But he promises us that in doing that, we find life. We only find life by turning away from our life and following after him. That's if you want to sum it up, that's the point. Tweet that if you want. Y'all were supposed to laugh, and you didn't. Ooh, that's a rough start. Okay, so we're going to look at three kind of different parts of our culture and see how they view work, and then identify how Jesus would criticize or confirm them. And the first group we're going to look at is our traditionalists. Traditionalists tend to idolize the past. Now, a traditionalist, as a culture, there's not a ton of them around where we are. Americans weren't traditionalists. That's why we moved to America. A traditionalist believes that the old ways are the best ways, and they want to hang on to family and to commitment. They want to bless loyalty just as much as they possibly can. There is, traditional cultures, which would be kind of the older European cultures. It would have been American culture really more before World War II. And then there's different kind of segments within society that are more traditional than others, right? So like the South, Mississippi is a very traditional culture. When you go to an Ole Miss football game, you feel like you're at a family reunion. I had a friend who went to a supper club in Mississippi, and he was from South Carolina, but he married into this supper club, and he realized that everybody at this dinner table had all gone to high school together, they had all gone to college together, they had all been in fraternities together, they had all moved back to Jackson, Mississippi together, and everybody at the table of this 12-person supper club, except him, everybody at that table had dated everybody else at the table. That's kind of the traditionalist culture. Like, it's about us. It's about us. If you want to see kind of, the ultimate example of a traditionalist culture, right now everybody's watching the Downton Abbey miniseries. And that's all that it's about. It's kind of traditionalist culture, faithfulness, loyalty to people who've been loyal to you, coming into the modern century, right? And the modern era, and last week, the big question was, you had this guy whose family had been farming this piece of property since the Napoleonic Wars. Are we going to let him stay on his family's land? We did. We let him stay. The traditionalists won this time. That's kind of the mentality toward work. You see it about the only thing that really you can point to in America where you see that clearly. Would be when General Motors, 70 years ago, 50 years ago, they promised to take care of their employees forever. Right? They put together this medical pension plan where they were going to take care of their employees forever. Now, that's a very noble purpose. That's a noble idea. Financially, it was a failure. Nobody knew how long forever was going to be, right? And we didn't know, how expensive medical care was going to be and how long people were going to live. And it almost bankrupted the company. But it's a noble idea. You work for us. We're going to take care of you. And that's kind of where you see this traditionalist mentality. What does Jesus... I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking to this. We're going to get over this one the quickest because none of you are traditionalists. You know how I know this? If you were a true traditionalist, you wouldn't be here. We're an 8-year-old church. You would be sitting in church next to your parents on the pew that your grandparents bought. But I do need to bring it out because even though you're not truly traditionalist, we're in a very conservative part of the country, and there's some overlap there. And I want to at least give it a nod. What does Jesus say to the traditionalists? He says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. He says, you can't follow me out of tradition. Now, I want you to think just a minute about the radical nature of that statement. He was speaking to first century Jews, to a culture that had lost everything. They had been persecuted minority for hundreds of years at this point. The Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans had all occupied their territory and had taken much of their culture. And all these people had left to be proud of was their tradition, their family. And Jesus is looking at these people who idolize their family, who value their family more than anything else, and says, you have to love me more than your family. Being part of your family is not enough. And there's a few applications we need to make from that. And the first one is this. Following Jesus cannot be a simple tradition. You just can't follow him out of tradition. Just because your parents went to church doesn't mean it's a tradition that you can pass down. And we have firm beliefs about traditions, and we need to clarify that following Jesus is not one. For instance, what do I mean when I say that? I'm going to talk about something that's very near and dear to some of your hearts. Okay, why do you love the college football team that you love? Well, you know, overwhelmingly, everybody in this room, most of the people in this room, have a football team that they believe deep in their hearts is the best team. And you believe it. You have statistics to back that up. You have experiences to back that up. And you honestly believe that it's true, and anybody who is an unbiased observer would know that your team is clearly the best team. But the fact of the matter is, you believe that Oklahoma is the Sooners are the best team because you grew up in an Oklahoma Sooner family. And you grew up near Oklahoma Sooners. Or you believe that Texas is the best team because you grew up in a Texas family. Or if you lived in Alabama, you would be absolutely convinced that Alabama was the best team, and you would have statistics and experiences to back that up. And you think it's something that you really believe. You think it's something that is an objective fact and truth of your life, and it is not. It's not. It's just something you just kind of inherited. Christianity has a lot of similarity to that. A lot of us grew up going to church. It was obviously important to somebody in our family, maybe our parents, maybe our grandparents. It was very important. Right? My mom started going to church when the man next door to her started taking her to church when she was 12 years old. She's still a member of that church today. My brother is sitting right next to her right now in that church today. It's important to the family, but it can't be handed down in the family. You have to make the decision. You have to actually have this experience with a very personal Jesus. And you have to decide whether you really love him more than you love your wife and your children and your father and your mother. And you have to follow him. He can't be a tradition. He's got to be a personal commitment. He is a person. He's a real person. And he asks you to follow him. Not just stay in the stream of your family's tradition. The first place where Jesus challenges the traditionalists is when he says, you have to follow me on your own, outside of your tradition. The second place he challenges traditionalists, and those of us who are just conservative more broadly, is he calls us to leave and follow. He calls us to see life as going somewhere. What I mean by that is this. Traditionalists and conservatives are typically firmly convinced that the nation's best days, that your best days are all behind us. And if we could just go back to the way things were in the 80s, everything would be perfect. Yeah, we really do believe that. Even the music was better. We really do believe that. And those feelings come up every time you look at a photo album. If we could just go back to when our kids were small. Those feelings come out every time we read the news. If we could just go back to life before abortion was legal. If we could just go back to life before whatever. And the Bible tells us very clearly, A, that is a human error. It's that we've always had. Even the Israelites, when they were coming out of slavery, when they faced the hardships of life in the wilderness, said, if we could just go back to when we were slaves. There's always this idea that if we could just go back, everything would be better. But when God cast Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, He put a sword there and He said, you can't go back. And when God created the world, He created the world with potential that needed to be discovered and refined. And both because of redemption and because of the way God created the world, He has made it clear to us that our best days are in front of us. That glory is in front of us. And we have to keep that in mind. The best, our hopes, our dreams are not behind us. God is with us and He is calling us to follow Him. He's calling us to go somewhere. And we need to be very conscious, sometimes just extremely conscious. Sometimes I refuse to let myself pull down photo albums. There are certain news sites and things that I know are going to discourage me that I just refuse to look at or listen to because I am not putting my hopes behind me. Our best days are in front of us, and we have to convince ourselves of that. We have to believe that because the Bible promises that we're going to a city. We're not going back to the Garden of Eden. We are going to a beautiful city that God has provided for us. In Hebrews, we're told of all the faithful saints in the Old Testament who left their home. And he says this, it's a beautiful way of saying it. He says, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared for them a city. And he's talking about their Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all those who were called to leave behind everything they had because they believed that what God was providing for them was better. And we cannot give up on that hope. What God has put out in front of us is better. The traditionalists can't idolize the past. But that's not the only people we're going to talk about. Actually, that was supposed to be the shortest part of my sermon. It didn't work out that way. Secondly, boomers and Generation Xers, that is me. This is me. I'm preaching to me. We idolize progress. We should idolize progress because, dadgummit, we made a lot of progress. We were the generation, the century of progress. And there's no way of denying that. The 20th century had some awful things happen, but it was an amazing century of progress. I mean, by any standard, look at communication. Before the 20th century started, if you wanted to send a message to somebody in Africa, you wrote a letter and it might or might not get there. Now you can pick up your iPhone, untethered, and face chat with somebody in Africa. That's progress. I mean, before the 20th century began, if you were born poor, you died poor. I mean, now anybody, any human with a computer can sew a product, advertise it on Facebook for almost free, and elevate themselves. You're not stuck. Poor rednecks from country towns in Tennessee can go to colleges at like Vanderbilt and become wealthy pastors. I know for a fact it can happen. That's progress. I mean, at the beginning of the 20th century, millions of people died from the flu, from smallpox, from polio. Do you remember that cholera epidemic a couple of years ago? Of course you don't, because it didn't happen. You know why it didn't happen? Because we have sewers. That's progress. That's progress. And it's very cool to criticize progress, but the people who are most critical of it like to write their criticisms on iPads and post them on Twitter, and the irony is thick. That's progress. The problem is we idolize it. Whatever produces progress is right. And the way we produce progress is required two things. One, it is required mobility. We can go to where the jobs are. We can go to where the opportunities are. Unlike anybody else in world history, we can pick up and move like that. The other idea that's produced progress is interchangeable parts. Fascinating idea, really. We're able to break machines and things down into parts. And then if we could improve the part, we can improve the whole machine. And what Jesus tells us is this. He comes to us. He comes to me. And he says, what does it profit you to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? And he says that on two or three issues. We have made progress. I believe that the gospel is more clearly proclaimed over the entire world now than it has ever been before. But it's a huge issue in America today that our children are not adopting our faith. It has been a huge issue for at least 20 years, 15 years, and pretty much any week. You can, if you'll just do a Google search on millennials in church, you'll see that they're not going. Millennials, our children are not adopting Christianity. Why not? Well, there's two reasons that I think are very clear, and we have to ask ourselves these questions. The first clear reason comes from what was called the National Survey of Youth and Religion, an enormous survey, multi-denominational. And the message that came back was, the question was, why are children not adopting the faith of their parents? And the answer that came back was, they are. They have adopted the faith of their parents, and the faith of their parents is progress. The faith of their parents is whatever produces financial gain is what matters. Whatever makes you a better person is what matters. When you're selecting a college, you don't look for a college where you know there's going to be a ministry and a place where your faith is going to grow. You go to the best college you can get into. When a job offer comes along, you don't ask yourself, is this job offer going to really cause my family to grow spiritually? You take the promotion. And once you get there, you find out if there's a church you like or not. Our number one commitment I'm talking about me, okay? I moved six times between the time I've turned 18 and 36. I'm talking about me. Never saw an opportunity I didn't say yes to. Let the consequences fall where they may. And I have to ask myself, were those correct decisions? How can I teach my children to value Jesus, the person of Jesus Christ, more than anything else when I have valued progress more than anything else? That's the question we have to ask. Because not only are we worshiping an idol, but we also have a complete misunderstanding of community. We tend to see ourselves as interchangeable parts. We can just move, get lifted out of this car, put into this car, and it'll all be fine. We see ourselves like interchangeable parts, but we're not. God tells us we're members of a body. And every move is not the taking of a carburetor out of one car and putting in another. Every move is a transplant of an organ. And it takes a long time for those organs to get healthy again. You don't just do it like that. And it stunts our growth more than we want to admit. And it stunts the growth of everybody we love. It stunts the growth of everybody we bring with us. I was shocked. I can talk about this a little bit more now because my family's not here. I was shocked and angry by how hard it was for my family to adjust to our last move. And that's why we don't plan to move again. I was mad at them. Why don't you love it here? This is better here than it was in Mississippi. It stunted their growth. I took them out of their body. It's hard for us to move. It also affects the culture that you leave. If you take an organ out of a body, that body misses it. And, you know, it's not just... They're not just cars that can have another part put in. And I think our churches, culture-wide, our churches, the growth in our churches has been stunted. Because we can't establish good communities. When I was first interviewing to leave RUF and become a church planner, the question I kept getting was, why do you want to leave RUF and become a pastor? And I would say, well, I'm tired of having my friends graduate and leave every 4 years. Every time I said that, I had a pastor look at me and say, that will never change. People don't stay put anymore. That affects your churches. That affects our communities. And it's part of the reason why the fastest growing churches right now are the ones that expect no community. Just go plug in. Go to church. Check that box. Because we don't even expect to hold each other accountable. You don't even expect to know each other. And it hurts us and affects us. What does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? Our mobility has affected us. Okay, that's us. Let's move on. Let's talk to the young people now. Let's get off, man. Let me get off my own back. That's good. Thirdly, the millennials. Millennials, for those of you who don't know the term, are the young folks. We don't have a name for them yet. And, we, you know, it's part of the problem was the whole change of the name. We can't really call them the zeros or, you know, like we did the 80s. So we've chosen the name millennials. And millennials don't idolize family and they don't idolize progress because they've really begun to be critical of progress. And this really, generationally, I would say it hits everybody about the age of 35 and down, maybe 30 and down, are much more critical of progress and are... The thing they tend to idolize is passion. The millennial view of work is you do what you enjoy. You know, Steve Jobs' advice to Stanford, do work that you love and you'll never have to go to work a single day. Do what you love and you'll never work a single day. You can't even say that to Stanford people, but he did. The millennials, the great contribution that I think that the new generation has made is two things. One is they brought to the workplace a much greater sense of awareness of our responsibility. You know, on one level, it's a little bit funny how pious like Starbucks is. You know, you read their cup and you're like, come on, really? You're trying to change the world through coffee. But on the other hand, at least they're aware of it, right? Like, they're trying to elevate the communities that they're buying these coffee beans from. That's much better than just exploiting them, taking their stuff and leaving them poor. I mean, at least they're aware of it. I'm not aware of that. I don't even ask myself the question, you know, where was this coat made? Was that person paid a fair wage? I appreciate the fact that millennials are at least aware of the question. And the second thing, the second big contribution is this contribution of passion. This idea that it's not good enough to just go get a job where you're miserable 40 hours a week so you can be happy on weekends. It's good to seek out work that you love. That's a good thing. You're actually more aware of kind of finding your gifts and plugging in a place where your gifts fit. And that's a good thing. It's sometimes a little bit comical. Right? You watch, my family used to watch America's Got Talent before they made Howard Stern into a judge. And, that's just who I am. Okay. There's some people I just cannot watch. But it was always funny because in the later rounds, they would ask the candidates, you know, why should we choose you? Why should the judges pick you? without fail, they would all say, because we're passionate about it. And I wanted to crawl through the television and go, that doesn't mean you're good. You know, Simon Cowell is doing some of you people a favor, because they would say on the Idol show, you've got to send me on to the next round because I'm passionate. And occasionally he would look at them and say, get a new passion. You're not good. You're wasting your time. And there is a tendency to go way too far on that. I do want you to know this. Everything that is worthwhile is going to be hard. Jesus says, whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And that this idea that if you do what you love, you'll never work a single day is just false. And that's a false view of work. But more importantly, it's a very false view of Christianity. Just because you love Jesus and Jesus loves you does not mean that this relationship, this following after him, is going to be painless. Quite the opposite. There are going to be days when it is hard. If it is never hard to follow after Jesus, then you really need to ask yourself, am I actually following Jesus, or am I just following my own desires and doing what I want? And that's a big problem. Tim Keller in New York talks a lot about people who he has baptized and who were growing in the church, and then after a year or so, they just completely disappear. And when he finds them, he says, what happened? I thought, you know, you were really plugged into the church. And he said, you know, they'll say to him, you know, church was really working for me then. And then I met this new girl or this new guy, and we moved in together, and this is working for me now. And this idea that following kind of what works for you now, what feels good now, what feels normal and natural now, what you're passionate about now, that's all that matters. That doesn't work in the real world, in work. If you're a pianist and you love to play piano, you're going to have to learn how to hold your fingers. You're going to have to learn the work of it if you really want to be free to play the most beautiful works that have ever been written. If you're passionate about a language, you know, Greek mythology, you're going to have to sit down and do the work of learning verb conjugations if you ever want to be truly free to read Homer. If you're passionate about following Jesus, then there are going to be times when he leads you through great, long periods of doubt and despair and sadness to make you strong, to convince you that he is real. He is more real than how you feel. He is more real than your circumstances. And there's no other way to convince you of that than to have you walk through periods when you don't feel him at all. When King David writes in the 23rd Psalm, you lead me down paths of righteousness for your own name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of great darkness, you are with me. And there's a tendency of young Christians to believe that it's wrong. There's no joy. If there's no freedom, if there's no joy, if there's no passion to the Christianity, that it's not real. And I want you to know, if your Christianity is real, there will come great times when there's no passion. Just like if your love for your spouse is real, then you'll be faithful and gracious even when they're sick, even when they're poor, even when there's no passion. And walking through those times brings freedom. Keller is known to say, as long as you're only willing to use Christianity as, if you're only willing to use Christianity because it works, then it will never be true, and it will never actually make your life better. It won't work. But when you come to Christianity and you believe it because it is true, just because it's true, then it will transform your life, and ultimately it will work. But you can't believe it because it works. You have to believe it because it's true. It's true even when it doesn't feel like it. And in following him, we find freedom. Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And they answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham, and we've never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" But Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin." Following Jesus makes you truly free, not free in the sense that you're able to do whatever feels right and good. It makes you truly free in the sense that you find life, that you find true life. I guess there's two ways of looking at a fish in a fishbowl. You could say, wow, he's awfully restricted. He can only go, you know, in this bowl. He would be much more free if we took him out of the bowl and threw him in the floor. He'd have more room. He would have more room to die. Sometimes you have to accept your restrictions so that you can live. Following Jesus is restrictive. There are places where you can't go. There are things that you can't do. There are things you have to say no to. You have to say no to yourself. There are things that you're not going to enjoy passion about. But within those restrictions is life. He knows you. He knows how he created you to live. And to all of us, to the most conservative traditionalist in the room and to the most progressive millennial in the room and everyone in between, he calls us to find life by following him. Please pray with me. Our Father in heaven, we pray that you would make Jesus better to us. I pray that you'd make him appear beautiful. I pray that we would see and feel the reality of the freedom that he offers. Father, I pray that we would follow him and find life. And all of us are going to have to find something to say no to. Say no to their tendency to find life in the past. Say no to their tendency to find life in progress and change. Or say no to the tendency to find life in just untethered freedom. I pray that you would give us the grace to find life following Jesus. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. That's a real